Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM-LP, Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research, development, and innovation. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of our hundreds of past programs over the past 10 years at radioinvivo.net. The Burroughs Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Burroughs Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. It's also a pleasure to acknowledge the underwriting support of Dr. Bob Condor of Carolina Neuropsychological Service of Raleigh and Chapel Hill. Bob provides neurocognitive evaluations and neurofeedback for sports concussions and optimal sports performance. You can learn more about Carolina Neuropsychological Service at carolinacns.com. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by Chapel Hill Eye Care, located at 235 South Elliott Road in Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill Eye Care provides comprehensive eye care to people of all ages. Healthy eyes for a lifetime. Chapel Hill Eye Care, 919-968-4774. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the Triangle Center for Evolutionary Medicine, or TRISEM, a nonprofit center exploring the intersection of evolutionary science and medicine. TRISEM is jointly operated by Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, North Carolina State University, and North Carolina Central University. TRISEM is an incubator that promotes innovative developments in the theory and practice of evolutionary medicine by fostering cross-disciplinary collaborations among Triangle-based scholars, physicians, public health workers, and more. And last but not least, it's my pleasure to acknowledge the underwriting support of North Carolina State University's Genetic Engineering and Society Center, or GES Center. The GES Center functions at the nexus of natural science, engineering, and the social sciences and the humanities. It includes multiple disciplines, stakeholders, and publics in collaborative research, education, and engagement, generating knowledge and fostering balanced and inclusive dialogue regarding emerging genetic engineering technologies and products. The GES Center is working to better understand the technical, ethical, and societal dimensions of genetic engineering in order to address the needs of society. For more information, visit the GES Center website, go.ncsu.edu/GES. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. Ecstasy, awe, communing with nature, or a feeling of oneness with the universe. Religious faith, where do these transcendental experiences come from? Are they real epiphanies or the products of a particular mode of brain chemistry? Those are the types of questions that preoccupy and inform the research of my guest on Radio In Vivo today, and she is pursuing some unique methods to gain some insights. Dr. Patty Van Kappelen is an experimental social psychologist. Until recently, she was a postdoc and then a research assistant professor at UNC, working with Barbara Fredrickson. But now she is lab director at the Duke Interdisciplinary and Behavioral Science Research Center, the IBRC. She is a native of Belgium and earned her PhD in social psychology from the Université Catholique de Louvain. I hope I pronounce that roughly correctly. She also holds two master's degrees from that university, one in psychology and another in biblical studies, which we will get into. Patty Van Kappelen, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
I'd like to start, Patty, with your most recent publication, which brought your work to my attention, and that is your study called Effects of Oxytocin Administration on Spirituality and Emotional Responses to Meditation, which appeared in the journal Social, Cognitive, and Affective Neuroscience in September. So first of all, tell us about this remarkable natural substance called oxytocin. It's gotten a lot of publicity in the last couple of years and has been roughly referred to as the love molecule or the love chemical.
Yes.
What exactly is oxytocin, and why does it appear to be so important?
Yeah, so oxytocin is a polypeptide. It's synthesized in the hypothalamus, and it's basically released both in the forebrain and also more peripherally in the rest of the body. So it acts as a neuromodulator, affecting many regions of the brain and also as a hormone in the rest of the body. It's naturally secreted through, for example, sexual intercourse, or also like non-sexual touch, like a massage, or also playing with your children, basically contact with loved ones, close and warm contacts with loved ones.
Breastfeeding even, I understand.
Yes, yes. It has been studied at first mostly for its role in childbirth. So it helps with contractions, and also it helps with milk ejection and breastfeeding. That has been basically where the research started. And then more recently, psychologists have started to be really interested in oxytocin because it seems to be implied in social bonding and empathy and trust. And for oxytocin's role in these important social processes, it has gained a lot of attention recently, being called the love hormone, although it's not always the love hormone. There are like certain contexts in which oxytocin does not seem to promote this unconditional love. It's more related to your in-group, you know, the people you're close with. But it's definitely implicated in important social processes that helps us interacting with others on a higher level.
I see. So what was the background of this particular study? Why did you undertake it, and what were your working hypotheses?
Yeah, so we started from, you know, this research in psychology showing that oxytocin promotes trust, empathy, even toward the pain of a stranger. We thought that maybe these like social effects of oxytocin might also promote spirituality, and especially its social connectedness component. So spirituality can be defined as this like personal affirmation in relationship with a higher power or the sacred. And it has some connectedness component to this definition, which is this relationship to a higher power, sense of connectedness with people around us, and also some meaning component, the belief in a larger meaning to life. And we reason that oxytocin might promote a certain mindset that is conducive of those spirituality-like beliefs.
I see.
So we hypothesize that, you know, oxytocin would increase spirituality. We also reason that if it increases spirituality, maybe it will also help people derive more enjoyment from an activity that's often tied to spirituality or practiced by spiritual people, which is meditation. So we also hypothesize that people under oxytocin, because they experience greater spirituality, would also enjoy more meditation and derive more positive emotions from meditation.
I see. So a couple of pretty ambitious hypotheses.
Yes.
So what was the design of the study itself?
Yeah, so we had approximately 80 participants in the study, 80 male adults between 35 and 64 years old. And they came to our lab, and there they were randomly assigned to one or two conditions. So they either received oxytocin in the form of a nasal spray, or a placebo, also in the form of a nasal spray. Both the participants and the experimenter did not know which condition the participant was getting.
So it was double blind.
It was double blind design, yes. Mm-hmm. And the nasal sprays were exactly the same, except for the one active ingredient of oxytocin in one of them. So participants receive oxytocin or placebo, and then approximately 40 minutes later, we start giving them questionnaires and tasks. And this is to give a little bit of time for oxytocin to kind of work through the body.
Sure.
So they start by answering a couple of questions on spirituality. And there we use like a very simple question, which is spirituality important in your life? And we also administered a longer scale, which is called the spiritual transcendence scale. Basically, it's just like a scale that measures spirituality with more items like, I believe there is a larger meaning to life, or people are all interconnected, items like that.
Mm-hmm.
So right after that, participants were introduced to meditation. So all participants were not regular meditators. We asked them that at the beginning, and we introduced them to meditation with a 20-minute guided meditation. They were listening on headphones. After these 20 minutes, they answer again questionnaires related to their emotions and how they felt during the meditation. Then they were dismissed from the lab, and a week later, they completed another questionnaire online. And we repeated one of the questions on spirituality. Is spirituality important in your life? Again, mm-hmm. a week later.
Okay, so some interesting endpoints that you were measuring. What was the dosage of oxytocin, and was it just a single administration?
Yes, it was a single administration of like 24 IU. It's like typical in studies, at least in psychology, on oxytocin.
Okay.
So we kind of use the same dosage as what other studies have found to be efficient. And it is actually, you know, a pretty high dosage when you think about how, like, the natural levels of oxytocin.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a one-time, one single administration. And then all of the effects we were measuring were, you know, 40 minutes later or a week later.
I see. And do you have any indication of how much oxytocin actually reaches the brain in that situation? I know the blood-brain barrier is always often a big issue. Is there any measure from past studies or anything?
It's still very much debated. And even if it goes through the blood-brain barrier, it is not certain that that's the path through which oxytocin is affecting. So that is still very much debated in the research, like more on the biological side, not even in psychology.
Sure.
They're still debating on that question.
All right. Well, we'll stay tuned on that one. Why did you elect to use a placebo control in this particular study?
So there has been two other research that had been done before this one where they measured oxytocin in the blood or in saliva. And then they also measured spirituality. And they looked, you know, at the same time. So they looked at whether participants who have higher levels, natural levels of oxytocin, have also higher levels of spirituality. And they found that. Here in this study, we wanted to kind of go a step, you know, beyond that and look at one causal direction. Is really an increase in oxytocin will lead to an increase in spirituality? It's kind of impossible to tell when you're measuring these two things at the same time.
Sure.
So here we wanted to administer oxytocin and measure spirituality. And to have a control condition, the best, you know, control we could have was to put participants in exactly the same situation, except that in the other case, their nasal spray contained nothing. So okay. It gives like a very good control.
And allows you to see if you have an actual signal.
Yes, yes.
Okay, very good. And we're going to get to the results in just a second, but mm-hmm. I want to continue to kind of elaborate on the study design. Why did you do this in only men? Did you theorize that this might be some kind of sex-dependent effect?
So most of the research in psychology on oxytocin and most of the research that you might have heard about on oxytocin is actually run on a male sample. And that's because, like, there are many reasons for that. First of all, it's more simple. Because oxytocin can produce childbirth and is implicated in that, you know, you need to make sure that women are not pregnant when they come to do your experiment where you administer oxytocin. So it's a lot more, you know, intense when it comes to actually running the study. Mm-hmm. But more precisely, our hypothesis, first of all, were derived from this research done on male. And we also gathered data on women, but we didn't want to just analyze men and women together like they are exactly the same. The reason is that among women, there are like natural variations in oxytocin depending on their hormonal cycle, if they are on a hormonal therapy like birth control, or where they are, like if they're menopause or not menopause.
Sure.
So there are like many other factors that you need to control for when you study women and you give them oxytocin compared to men where it's more stable. So we looked at the results among men where we don't have to control for all of the hormonal, you know, factors. The goal is to also do the analysis among women. It may not happen in our particular study because for some random reason, it's the random assignment somewhat failed. And in the oxytocin condition, we actually have many women who were premenopause or menopause. And in the placebo condition, women with a very different profile. So it's mm-hmm. it's hard then to control for that. But in the idea is not that oxytocin will have completely different effects among men and women. Actually, that still remains to be tested. But we need to control for more factors when we study women.
So the biology, if you had women involved, is incredibly much more complex.
Yes, and okay. especially here we had a sample of people from 35 to 64, which represents a very, you know, diverse profile of women, especially regarding their hormonal status.
Why that particular age range? Were you excluding younger people because they're still developing and hormonally are still quite active? Not that people 35 to 64 are not hormonally active.
Yeah, no.
But
That wasn't the reason, but it's mostly because the past work we've been doing on meditation was among midlife adults, and we were interested in studying that age group, especially thinking about how can we promote important resources for them as they get older.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Well, Patty, tell us about the results of this very, very interesting study.
Yeah. So if I'm here to talk about it, that means we found something.
I certainly hope so.
So what we found is that participants who received the oxytocin nasal spray reported greater spirituality on the two measures we had compared to participants who were in the placebo condition. Interestingly, this effect was still present a week later. So not only they reported greater spirituality 40 minutes after placebo, but also a week later. As I told you, we used, you know, very
simple...
By
which time, I assume, the drug has long since cleared from their system.
Yes, okay. Yes. So there might be other more like psychological factors that may explain why it continues to last, mm-hmm. Remain to be tested.
Sure.
What is interesting, I think, also is that our measure of spirituality, the longer scale I talked about, included questions related to a sense of connection to others, but also of meaning. And what we found is that oxytocin not only increased this sense of connection, like we would assume from previous research, but also the belief that there is a larger meaning to life. We also found that participants in the oxytocin condition reported greater positive emotions derived from meditation. So they enjoyed more the meditation, and especially emotions that I call self-transcendence, such as awe and gratitude, basically emotions that would make sense to feel during meditation.
Mm-hmm.
They reported more of those.
Okay.
We also found that one aspect I haven't discussed yet is that we genotyped participants for two genes that are related to oxytocin signaling. One is more related to the reception of oxytocin, and the other is more related to the release of oxytocin. And we found also that the effects of oxytocin on spirituality were stronger among participants who had a certain genotype, oxytocin-related genotype. So I think that was interesting to think that, yes, there is this general effect, but it's also important to take into account our genes when it comes to oxytocin and when we administer oxytocin.
Indeed. Well, you know, obviously you couldn't take it the next step, at least not yet. But it's worth wondering, you know, where that goes. And, you know, are we genetically inclined or disinclined to spirituality? I assume you will be following up on that one.
Researchers have tried to find the God gene, how they call it. I'm not sure I'm trying to get there.
Okay. Well, Patty, I have several questions for you about some of the potential implications of the oxytocin study. First of all, do you think this could lead to development of oxytocin as an intervention, a therapeutic modality? And what came to mind reading through your materials was, you know, potentially effective in depression, for example?
So there is a whole line of research that's actually investigating the extent to which we can use oxytocin as a therapy for diverse, you know, psychological issues. Mm-hmm. This line of research is more in clinical psychology, which is not exactly what I do. So that wasn't really the goal when we took, you know, when we ran the study.
Okay.
But it's true that both spirituality and meditation have been related to better health and well-being. And actually, one of the active ingredients of meditation is positive emotions. So the fact that we can kind of increase both spirituality and positive emotions in meditation as a result of oxytocin might be interesting for those interested in their, you know, implications for improving well-being. However, this is really the first study showing this, so I think we should consider this evidence as preliminary.
Okay.
There's also a lot of questions that arise when you start thinking about implementing this for, you know, in the larger population. So we administered oxytocin in a very controlled lab setting. We don't know how it's going to work when context and situation and just life happens and we administer oxytocin. We know, for example, that in if you administer oxytocin in a more competitive situation, then you're going to start defending more your in-group and not really try to be empathic with the person you're in competition with.
Mm-hmm.
So there are like important boundary conditions to the effects of oxytocin that, you know, are important to think about when you want to implement that in real life. And then we don't know yet how it's going to, you know, how much oxytocin do people need to get the effect, how it's going to work long term and so forth. So I think it's it's an important first step, but it's just a first step.
Okay. Well, what's the second step? How do you plan yourself in your own research to follow up on this study?
Yeah, so we're actually, we just finished the data collection of a longitudinal study where we followed people over long term, so over the course of 16 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be interested in looking at more natural levels of oxytocin that we measured at the beginning of the study and at the end of the study, and look at whether, for example, if you have greater oxytocin at the beginning of the study, do you have like a greater boost in spirituality over the course of the study? And in that particular study, people are learning to meditate. So same thing, are they going to get more positive emotions from meditation? And then in turn, does, you know, greater spirituality or do greater positive emotion also support oxytocin and increase oxytocin in return? Like there are many causal directions that we could explore with a more longitudinal design. So that's something I'm interested in. And then a little bit more broadly, because of my interest in religion and religious practices, I'm really wondering if, for example, religious rituals or going to church are these contexts in which oxytocin is naturally increased.
Mm-hmm.
Because we feel a certain sense of communion with people around us and that might, and potentially with a god, so that might also release oxytocin. I think that would be absolutely fascinating for me.
Well, we'll certainly keep an eye out for new publications along the lines you describe. Well, Patty, one thing that occurred to me to wonder about as I read through your materials, is there any analogy here to psychedelic drugs, which are known to enhance feelings of oneness and spirituality and are certainly being explored for therapeutic uses as well?
Yeah, so there has been some research on where they would give pretty much LSD to participants and then investigate more like mystical experiences. I think the analogy here is that we're giving a drug to people and then we're observing that it increase, you know, their spirituality. However, in the oxytocin study, participants were not able to tell if they got oxytocin or the placebo. So I think that would be pretty different from a study using psychedelic drugs where...
Indeed.
Yes, I think people are, you know, able to tell.
Right. So they could not tell.
They could not tell.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, so it's a more subtle effect, definitely.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So people aren't sitting there tripping out.
No,
stuff.
Not at all.
Okay.
No. I think the intensity of the experience is pretty different. I don't know if the content of the experience is different. We should compare that.
Sure.
But I think, you know, with the psychedelic drugs, it showed that dopamine or the dopamine system is implicated. And here we're showing that there's this other system related to oxytocin that's also implicated in spirituality. Spiritual beliefs.
Okay.
So we're kind
what
of start mapping.
What system is that in terms of brain function?
So, as I said, it's mostly a system that's implied in social bonding, it seems like, and helping us, you know, build relationships. And first of all, among women, to help with reproduction.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you given any thought to doing some imaging studies at some point?
Well, I don't really have the expertise to do that. I think it would be interesting, but I would need, you know, to collaborate with someone whose expertise it is. I'm really mostly interested in the spirituality component. So what are the different biological systems, but also more like emotions or experiences in life that seem to support spirituality?
Mm-hmm.
So I think I would focus more on better understand how spirituality can change over time and even over the course of a day. When are your beliefs more salient or not? And that's really the direction where I would like to go.
So that's really where you're coming from.
Yeah,
the biology is of perhaps a little bit less interest.
Yeah, well,
in your own work.
It's very interesting to me, but it was less central to my training too. So I'm very grateful for my collaborators also on this paper, Susanna Isged, who is actually still at UNC, and then Baldwin Way at Ohio, who really helped me, you know, interpreting also the data related especially to genotype. So yeah, it's a great work of collaboration.
Now, how did you actually acquire the oxytocin, and is it an FDA approved substance, or how did all that work?
Oh, through many steps that our lab manager went through. I know it was pretty complicated, but we had also an MD on our research team, so we needed prescriptions for each participant, and we received the nasal spray, from a company that just does that, like the packaging, to make sure that the placebo and the oxytocin nasal spray look exactly the same. So it was, I know, a whole lot of work for a lab manager, which also, I guess, explains why there are not so many research on oxytocin, because it's a lot of work.
I see. And so is it FDA approved at this point? It is. Okay. So that must have helped get your IRB approval then.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you also had, your, as you mentioned, your subject participate in guided meditation, and you saw some significant results. Tell us a little bit more about that component.
Yeah. So participants, it was one of our recruitment criteria to not be a regular meditators. We wanted people who would, you know, kind of learn about meditation in the lab. And they listened to this 20-minute guided meditation. We actually had two different types of meditation. One was more like the mindfulness, you know, focusing on the present moment. And the other one was more loving kindness meditation. So generating this warm and these warm feelings toward yourself and toward others. The results actually were the same for the two types of meditation. So we just collapsed them together. We also asked, you know, right after how participants felt as a result of this meditation by, you know, very simply asking them to self-report. Mm-hmm. Did you feel awe? Did you feel gratitude? And so forth. We had another more implicit measure of emotion. And, you know, we found the results on the two different measures. So it was, again, like a very controlled lab setting in which they were learning to meditate, but they were by themselves in the little cubicle listening to this meditation on headphones. And apparently they managed to feel some emotions.
Good. Okay. Well, generally speaking, Patty, do you think that this study confirms or at least starts to confirm that there really is a neurobiological link between oxytocin and these feelings of spiritual connectedness?
Yeah, I think this study, along with the two other, you know, more correlational studies that I've talked about, point to the fact that oxytocin may be implicated in spirituality. This doesn't mean, of course, that oxytocin evolved for the purpose of creating spirituality. It has definitely other functions that are more central and more important. It also does not mean that spirituality is just a result of oxytocin, because as we said, you know, psychedelic drugs are also implicated, so dopamine system might be implicated. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, spirituality is just a very complex phenomenon and very likely supported by many different aspects in our biology and also in our experiences. So I'm not trying to reduce spirituality to a biological phenomenon, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say that oxytocin is the spiritual hormone in addition to being the love hormone.
Right.
But still, it seems like there are like certain, you know, biological systems that seem to be implicated and help us develop these spiritual beliefs. Again, it doesn't mean that everybody who takes oxytocin will become spiritual. But in this study, what was interesting to me too is that we measured whether participants were affiliated to a traditional religion. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to control for that because typically if you're affiliated to religion, you will have a higher level of spirituality as well. However, if you're not affiliated to religion, there is pretty a big range of variability in your spirituality. Some people are not religious but still spiritual, and some people are not religious and not spiritual. So we wanted to control for that. And what was interesting is that the effect actually appeared for people who are not affiliated to a traditional religion.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I think that was interesting to me, that it seems oxytocin seemed to open us to, you know, thinking a little bit more broadly, even if it's not something that's, you know, central to our faith, you know, in the beginning.
I see. I wanted to ask you to explore that a little bit further, because as I'm sure you're well aware, the fastest growing religion, if you will, in the U.S. these days is the good old spiritual but not religious designation, which, you know, is quite common, and many, many people feel that way. So it sounds like this research kind of reflects that to a certain extent.
I think it's the focus on spirituality. Here we wanted to not just focus on traditional religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to be a little bit broader than that and talk about a higher power, which could be a god for certain people, or the sacred, and this like more diffuse sense of connection with the rest of the world and people. So we wanted to be a little bit broader than traditional religion, and therefore also study these people who would identify as spiritual but not religious. So I think it speaks to them. It's also related to other research I've done on these, you know, positive emotions and how feeling certain positive emotions may also make us realize that there might be a larger meaning to life or think about the idea of a higher power. And I think these types of experiences really speak to these spiritual but not religious folks.
I see. You are listening to Radio In Vivo, and my guest today is Dr. Patty Van Kappelen from Duke University, who studies the neurobiological basis, among other things, of ecstasy and religiosity. Well, Patty, we've explored the oxytocin study in some detail now, and at this point I'd like to hear about some of your other research projects. You actually come to all of this as a non-biologist with your background in psychology. So to begin this section of the conversation, would you tell us a little bit more about your scholarly background, including the degree in biblical studies? Which
absolutely,
I think you're
yeah.
the first guest I've ever had who had such a degree.
Yeah, I don't think many people have it.
Indeed.
Especially in conjunction with psychology. So I studied psychology, social psychology back in Belgium. And I think since the first year of my psychology degree, I also started another degree in biblical studies. Since the very beginning, I've always been kind of fascinated by religion, and I wanted to study it from a psychological perspective. And yes, it gives me tools to understand, for example, why people turn to religion, how does being or identifying as religious change the way people behave and think or feel. But it doesn't give you as much information about the content of the religion. So the degree in biblical studies for me was helpful in better understanding Christianity, because it was like a Christian degree, which basically reflects, you know, the major belief that the participants I'm studying have. So both in Belgium and here in the US, most of my participants identify as Christian. So this degree in biblical study was really about studying the biblical text, the languages of the text, you know, biblical Hebrew and Greek, and then the history.
I was so impressed that you actually are fluent in those languages.
Well, fluent, let's not exaggerate,
okay.
But I can read them, that's for sure. I wouldn't speak them.
Okay. So we're not going to have a chat in Aramaic.
No. Yeah, and the history of interpretation of those texts. So the way I've tried to kind of put these two things together, which I guess at first seemed to be very different, is I've started to study how positive emotions are constructed in biblical Hebrew and in the Hebrew Bible. And that study is also similar to how I'm trying to study, you know, positive emotions in psychology. So it kind of gives me, you know, like a broader understanding of emotions and a better appreciation of how our construction and our understanding of emotions can change over time. So I was, you know, really fascinated by these two areas and did my PhD in psychology of religion,
mm-hmm.
Which is a field, and really, you know, kind of put these two things together. When I got my PhD in 2012, then I moved to UNC as a postdoc to work with Barb Fredrickson, who's like the world expert on positive emotions and kind of, you know, pursue that interest and study more positive psychology, which is the psychology that's really interested in human flourishing and how to become the best versions of ourselves.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I hope to have her on this program someday.
Oh, she's great. Yes.
Absolutely. Well, you kindly led me to a page on your own website, which we will have links to once we post the podcast of this, that summarizes some of your past research projects. And I'd like to kind of explore them by category. First of all, tell us about the search for self-transcendence. What does that mean exactly? And how have you conducted research in that area?
Yeah, so self-transcendence, I use it as like a broad term to try to understand this phenomenon when people are trying to go beyond their like self-interest and try to transcend themselves and become a part of a larger reality. So this, again, this feeling of interconnectedness and larger meaning. So historically, people have, you know, thought about the search for self-transcendence more in like a traditional religion or in terms of spirituality. So my interest in that category is what are the experiences that foster self-transcendence? This feeling that everything is not just about yourself and your little world and your everyday concerns. And in that research, I was interested in those self-transcendent emotions, such as awe and admiration.
Mm-hmm. I think which you've labeled STPE, or yes. Self-transcendent positive emotions.
Yes.
Got to have those acronyms,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so if you think about, you know, watching a beautiful sunset, or seeing on TV someone doing like a very kind action and helping people, these emotions like give you this warm feeling in the chest, and they're really about seeing someone or something being greater or better than the self. They're really not about our own goals or what we're trying to achieve in life. They take us out of that. So I wanted to see if those types of experiences would also promote spirituality. And we tested that by having participants, you know, watch videos or remember a time when they felt those emotions. And just like in the oxytocin study, ask them right after, how spiritual are you, or how much do you agree with the following statements related to spirituality?
Mm-hmm.
So much of it was actually pretty new research, because much of the past research has investigated negative experiences. And as you may guess, yes, when we feel in distress or when we're losing someone we love, these are like very negative experiences where your faith can become like a profound source of coping and help. And definitely people turn to their faith in those moments. That does not mean that when you feel good, you just don't need your faith anymore, or you're not spiritual anymore because you kind of, yeah, don't need it. I wanted to see if even in those positive experiences, there is a different way maybe of that these beliefs are salient. Mm-hmm. And that's what we found.
Well, what about life experiences that threaten that faith or degrade it?
Yeah, so they're like... So could you give me an example?
Oh, for example, if you have someone close to you who dies, mm-hmm. and suddenly you think, maybe this faith I've had all along is, you know, the prayers were not answered, for
yes.
example.
Yes. So that is also, yeah, that's definitely another common experience. So, of course, not everybody find comfort in their faith. They can also interpret, like, for example, hearing that they have an illness or something like that, that can challenge their faith. Then your religion will not be like a useful coping mechanism because you have like some distress around your faith.
Mm-hmm.
There are some researchers studying that as well. Also anger at God, like why did God do this to me? And when do people... you know, think that God did something bad to them, or when do they think that God is still the answer and, you know, the person toward whom to turn. So there are like, there is some fascinating research in that area as well. But I think the majority still usually find comfort in their faith, even if there are like some elements mm-hmm. where they feel less comfortable with, they usually find a source of comfort and they use their religion to compensate, you know, the negative experiences.
Which would seem to account for the longevity of both organized religion and feelings of spirituality in general.
Yeah, so that's for sure. It's one of the mechanisms. There are many mechanisms, but religious coping, it provides this like sense of security and comfort that is important for well-being.
I see. Well, another category that you've done some work in, which is pretty fascinating, is religion, health, and the mediation role of positive emotions. Tell us about that, because the whole area of health benefits mm-hmm. of having those feelings of religiosity or spirituality is something that's gotten a lot of attention.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you think about it, there has been a lot of research now showing that apparently religious individuals live longer and have higher well-being compared to non-religious individuals. Church attendance is one of the strongest predictor among the religious predictors. And most of that research, they thought that the social aspect of religion is what is helpful. So after studying whether there is a relation between religion, spirituality, and health, they've tried to understand why that relation exists.
Sure.
And one of the mechanisms...
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because yeah. that seems like a kind of a logical next step. Is that the social aspect would be very important in terms of health promotion?
It is definitely important, but it's just one of the different mechanisms.
Okay.
So... yes, social support is important. Like if you think about people who go weekly to church, they have like a, you know, important social network and social support that comes from attending church on a weekly basis and sometimes even more often than that.
Mm-hmm.
However, going to church can bring other benefits that are, you know, beyond just social support. For example, having meaning in life. So kind of have a system of understanding the world that also brings, you know, comfort and helps you dealing with negative events. So meaning is another way that religion promotes well-being.
Indeed. And what about the importance of ritual?
Yeah, so I think it's very interesting that, you know, religion has this weekly ritual. So we go, people go to church on a weekly basis. They experience social support, yes. It's also reaffirmation of their belief that is important. But in my research, I was interested in this other component, which was less studied at that time, which is the emotions that people feel when they go to church. And more specifically, these, again, positive and self-transcendent emotions. So in my research, I wanted to see if the fact that people report feelings of awe and joy and peacefulness are those positive emotions that we know from other research are very helpful for well-being. Are these also active ingredients in this relation between religion and health? So we found that, yes, they seem to be important. So when people report that they felt those during church, they also report greater well-being. So it is important to not just focus on the social support. It is one important mechanism for sure, but there are other aspects of the religious rituals that might be helpful for well-being.
I see. Very good. Well, and last but not least, Patty, you've also looked at an area called religion and social influence toward a better understanding of religion's dark side. Tell mm-hmm. us a little bit about that work.
Yeah, so far we talked about a lot of positive things about religion, and, you know, definitely the research is supporting that religion is helpful and beneficial to many people. Unfortunately, there is also some research showing that there is a relation between religion and certain prejudice. Prejudice against group who seem to value, to threaten the values, like the traditional religious values.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So in that research, they found that religious individuals show greater prejudice attitudes, but also prejudice behaviors. And I was trying to understand that and not only think about in-group and out-group, but we don't like others who don't think the same way as us, like we don't like atheists, for example, but also to think about other means through which religion may kind of unfortunately promote this prejudice. And that's how I started to study social influence. So we know that religion is a powerful source of social influence. And in my research, which isn't bad in itself, you know, like obedience and isn't bad in itself, but it could be used or harnessed for the worse as well. So in my research, I'm just going to summarize one of the studies, I think, that exemplified this line of research.
Sure.
We found that basically reminding people of religion. So we had, you know, participants who came to our lab and we remind them about religion, and to another group we didn't do that. And then the experimenter, let me start over.
Go right ahead.
So in this experience, the participant was reminded of religion or not.
Okay.
And they also were asked to create a small advertisement for a company, completely unrelated.
Mm-hmm.
They received feedback on this advertisement, and the feedback was always very mean. Like, oh, this is like a really bad advertisement. There is no creativity. Pretty bad feedback. From another participant. So our participants were led to think that there might be someone else in the lab who was giving this, you know, feedback. And then our participants had the chance to actually seek revenge. So we gave them the opportunity to choose the questions we would ask that other, you know, fake participant. And they had the choice to choose very difficult questions or not so difficult questions. And what we found is that participants who were reminded of religion in general chose less difficult questions, so showing this, you know, pro-social effect that's common in the literature. But when the experimenter suggested to choose difficult question, so kind of ask the participant to choose difficult question, participants who were reminded of religion chose even more difficult questions than participants who were not reminded of religion. So they were submitting, you know, submissive to this request, mm-hmm. even if the request wasn't a really nice request.
Certainly seen a lot of examples of that.
So I think
the world.
These are like very, you know, it's just like a lab study, very controlled. But I think, you know, it starts, you know, shedding lights on other processes that might be happening and where we have like very concrete examples in the news, unfortunately.
Yes, indeed. Particularly these days.
Yeah.
Well, Patty, we are just about out of time, but I don't want to let our time expire today without hearing more about your current position as Associate Director of the Duke Interdisciplinary Behavioral Research Center, or IBRC. I take it you've only recently assumed that job. Tell us a little bit about the center and your responsibilities.
Yeah, so I started there in September, so it's pretty recent, but the IBRC is a large, you know, research facility that offers research space and research support to researchers at Duke, researchers in social and behavioral sciences, such as psychologists, economists, and so forth. And we basically, you know, help them conduct their research by providing space, support. We also have a participant pool from the community. So if there are members of the community who want to participate in our studies, they can go to the website of the center and sign up.
Sure, and we'll have that link on our site as well.
So my responsibility there is, you know, to make sure everything is going fine and provide support if researchers have questions regarding their designs. And we also have a small grant program, so I administer that.
I see.
But I definitely have still a lot of time to think about my research.
Well, that was the next question. Certainly, are you going to be able to continue carrying on with your research program?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm continuing working on all of those questions that we talked about today. And I definitely have the time and the resources to continue that. So it's very exciting.
And well, you've certainly got a lot of questions that remain to be answered. Well, Patty, it's been great having you on Radio In Vivo today.
Thank you.
And I wish you all the best for continued success as you explore the psychological and biological aspects of spirituality and religiosity.
Thank you very much.
We've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check the website, RadioInVivo.net, or our Facebook site for the lineup of upcoming shows. Join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. If you enjoy the program, we ask that you please make an effort to support this station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. One great way to do that is to log on to the WCOM website, wcomfm.org. Click on the Donate Now button and get the details on how to make a small monthly contribution, or a large monthly contribution would be fine too, via a secure donation on PayPal to help keep this independent voice of the community on the air. Now be sure to stay tuned for one of our most popular shows on the WCOM schedule, The Courage Cocktail with Leanne McClymont. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you next time.